Fox is certainly dangerous. It's in its own category of dangerousness. But MSNBC and CNN, to a lesser extent, are engaged in dangerous propaganda for a case that has not yet been proven. And I'm not looking at this like, I don't believe that it's like no holds barred, anything we can do to get rid of Trump, even lying about that. No. That is going to have a far-reaching set of ramifications for us as a society, for the credibility of the news media in general.
That's Jeremy Scahill, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jeremy Scahill. Journalism, truth or propaganda? An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion, said Thomas Jefferson. And what happens to democracy when one of the major pillars of information, that is journalism, is under attack from the highest office in the land? We live in an era where the president openly singles out journalists by name and denounces them. And when he's at a rally, he incites his followers to hiss and boo the press. Fake news, he tweets. The media, he declares, are a stain on America. Apparently, any journalist that does not express admiration and adoration for the president is not doing his or her job. Only Fox can be trusted. Journalism, at least in theory, has one essential job: to dig out and communicate the facts about what powerful individuals and institutions are doing, and to hold them accountable. No one is above criticism. Our guest today is Jeremy Scahill. He's an award-winning journalist and author of the bestsellers Blackwater and Dirty Wars. He's reported from war zones around the world. His work has sparked several congressional investigations. He's a founding editor of The Intercept and was the subject of the film Dirty Wars, which was nominated for an Academy Award. He spoke at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And now, Jeremy Scahill.
I wonder if I am the first person to deliver the distinguished lecture here that was expelled from the university. Maybe. Some years ago, I was invited here to do an event with Tammy Baldwin, and it was in the journalism department. And the professor who introduced me said that I was an alum of the journalism school here. And I said, fake news. I said, well, actually, I couldn't get into the journalism program here, and I probably couldn't get in today. And I think it's true. I don't think I would be accepted into the University of Wisconsin-Madison today with my test scores and my ability to fill dots in on the standardized tests. I still am a bit surprised to be on this stage at something called a distinguished lecture, given my academic history. And so maybe before I get into the topic at hand, which I'm going to talk about covert wars, the Trump moment, and sort of how we got to where we are and where I see things going from here. But maybe I should share a little bit about how I even ended up in front of you today. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Both my parents are nurses. And I wouldn't say that we were raised in some kind of a, communist family or even necessarily an activist family, but raised by parents who cared about other people and definitely had a sense of justice and the idea that we are not just what we do every day at our jobs, we're also what we do to change and confront injustice and how we treat each other. And our house was filled with books that I didn't bother to read until I came back to visit them after moving out of the house. But incredible revolutionary texts. And I because kids are brash and arrogant. I was that way. Kids are also wonderful, but they can be brash and arrogant and know-it-all. I never really even bothered to ask my parents about what they were like or what they were interested in before my brother, sister, and I were born, until much later in life. And it turned out that there was this whole story about my dad that I really wasn't aware of. My father comes from a Irish Catholic immigrant family. His parents both came over on on boats. And in Catholic, in a lot of Irish Catholic families, if you have two sisters and you're the boy, the assumption is you're going to go and be a priest. And my dad was on that trajectory. He was going to, you know, study to be a priest. He grew up on the south side of Chicago. And he didn't end up becoming a priest, obviously. But he was turned on to politics because of the rise of the faith-based left. People like Father Daniel Berrigan, the late Jesuit priest who, with his brother Philip Berrigan, in May of 1968, two Catholic priests, seven lay people from the Catholic Church, went into what was called a customs house in Catonsville, Maryland. And it was a facility where they stored the files for young men that were going to be drafted to go and fight in Vietnam. And these two Catholic priests, Dan, a Jesuit, Phil, a Josephite, which was a civil rights order at the time, went in the middle of the day with metal waste bins, and they proceeded to open the file cabinets where draft files were held for mostly African Americans in the area. And they took those files and they put them in front of the clerks in the office into these bins. And mind you, this is, you know, 1968, and it's Catholic priests dressed in what Dan and Phil used to call the monkey suit, you know, like with the white thing here. And I'm a bad secular Catholic. I don't remember what it's called, but my dad will yell at me later. They go into the parking lot, and Dan Berrigan, who is an incredible poet and writer and deep thinker who had been mentored by the monk Thomas Merton. You know, Thomas Merton was asked during the Vietnam War, whose side are you on? He said, I'm on the side of the people being burned. Think about that. In all these wars we see today, what does it mean to say you're on the side of the people being burned? So Daniel Berrigan and Phil Berrigan and their seven compatriots took these draft files and they put them in a pile in the parking lot. And they burned them with homemade napalm. And they had learned how to make that napalm because of the U.S. Army field manual recipe. And Dan Berrigan, who was the most well-known of the crew, had written a statement on behalf of the Catonsville Nine. And it began, "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children." That action and the audacity of people that were viewed as part of the establishment was what changed my father's entire life. And he ended up, much to the objections of his immigrant parents, my dad leaves Chicago, where he had been tutoring kids in the Cabrini-Green projects, and he went to the Catholic Worker in New York to live with Dorothy Day, who was a radical anarchist pacifist who, before converting to Catholicism, had been a journalist at the Daily Worker, the communist newspaper, and she built up this network of what they called houses of hospitality around the country and ultimately around the world. She is going to be a saint. She's in the process of canonization right now, but my dad lived with her, and she was a militant. On the one-year anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Dorothy Day put an article on the front page of the Catholic Worker that said, "Forget Pearl Harbor." And it was followed then by an article about the insanity that had gripped the country following that act and the hypocrisy of the United States government, which had refused to support people like Clarence Kalin from Madison, Wisconsin, who was a member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who went in the 1930s, before much of the world knew much about Adolf Hitler at all. 3,000 young Americans went to Spain to try to stop fascism before it took root in Europe. And the United States had a policy of non-engagement, of so-called neutrality. And that neutrality meant that they did nothing to stop Franco's murderous campaign. They did nothing to stop the air support that the Germans gave to Franco's fascist forces. And the Catholic Worker was a part of a debate that was about what people of conscience do in times of war and conflict and threats of nuclear warfare and people going mandatory into fallout shelters or bomb shelters. They used to go and protest during the drills that would be held in the 1950s, the air war drills. I'm sure some people in this room probably remember that. Ammon Hennessy, one of the anarchist members of the Catholic Worker, used to picket in front of the White House against every war. He was a World War I draft resister. And then one day a press man came up to him and said, you know, you're not going to change their minds. And he said, maybe so, but they sure as hell aren't going to change mine. And I've thought about that perspective on the world quite a bit. How obsessed are we with efficacy versus doing what's right? And so my dad lived there at the Catholic Worker with Dorothy Day in these very heady times. And there were well-known journalists and others at the Catholic Worker there. And Dorothy Day wanted to send them down to Cuba to participate in the Venceremos Brigades. And the aim of it at the time, Fidel Castro had issued a global call around the world for young people and others to come and cut sugarcane. It was called the Harvest of 10 Million Tons. And the idea was that Cuba was going to show that it could operate a self-sustained economy. And none of the sort of well-known people at the Worker wanted to go. And so Dorothy Day asked my dad. And my dad came back and he wrote an article for the Catholic Worker that defended the Cuban Revolution, even though it was won through revolutionary violence. And Dorothy Day put it on the front page of the Catholic Worker. And the title of that article was Up from Nonviolence. And in her accompanying On Pilgrimage column, she talked about how my dad and another young man who had gone to prison and was abandoned by the anti-war movement once he got to prison for resisting the draft, everyone was saying they should resist. She said that these two young men remind all of us that we don't hold the monopoly on what it means to be a Christian. And then this was a woman who was very much a liberation theologian before it was really even a term in Central and Latin America. And that was the end of my dad's, you know, official journey into, let's say, the world of journalism or activism, what have you. He spent the rest of his life, he's still alive, by the way, he spent the rest of his life doing healthcare in the most segregated city in the country, Milwaukee. So we grew up in a house not knowing this whole backstory about what our dad had done, and he went to Cuba and he met Fidel Castro and he was with North Vietnam, he was with Viet Cong. I mean, what, huh? We just knew him as our dad and we watched him, how he interacted with people. But that had a huge impact on us. And I was a terrible student in high school, atrocious student in high school. What's funny is I'm getting inducted tomorrow in Milwaukee into my high school's Hall of Fame. They're like, oh, we're gonna pull up some old pictures, and you know, we can even get the transcripts of your. I'm like, don't, please don't get the transcripts of my grades. I remember all my friends were going, you know, going away to college, and it's, you know, this really exciting moment in your, you know, junior senior year when you learn where you're going, and everybody said, I'm going to Notre Dame, I'm going to UW, and it's like I hadn't gotten in anywhere. I got accepted to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee on a probationary basis, and I went there, and you know, I was miserable. But I'll never forget when I ultimately made a decision to drop out of school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at the time, my dad saying to me that he supported it. And he said, you know, don't let school get in the way of your education. I think about that every day of my life. Because I don't know, if I hadn't been told that by my dad at a time when a lot of parents would have freaked out, you're leaving school, what are you going to do? You know, I don't know that I would do anything even close to what I do today. My guidance counselor told me that I should consider going into a trade, learn how to be a carpenter or a plumber. And in a way, I did, because I learned journalism as an apprentice, which is how I think you should learn journalism. This shouldn't be a profession or a career. Being a journalist in the belly of the empire is a way of life. Your fingers have to get dirty. You have to know how to talk to people from various aspects of society with varying education levels and meet them where they are and to try to tell stories that matter, and to try to hold the powerful accountable, and to try to give voice to those whose voices are either stripped away or not allowed. What am I getting at? The point I'm getting at is that I come to Madison, and I'm thinking, well, the goal has to be to get into the UW, and if I can just get into the UW, then I think, you know, I'll get it. I'll be fine in college. So I hope this person's not still working here and I get her in trouble. So I convinced someone in the admissions department at this university to enroll me under a special student status. And I wove this whole complicated tale for her. Anyway, it worked. So I get in. I'm in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Long story short, I realized it's not for me. And it wasn't that I was like some, you know, or something. It was that that way of learning wasn't where I was at that point in life. And so what I ended up doing was hitchhiking out to Washington, D.C., and I moved into the largest homeless shelter in the nation at the time, called the Center for Community for Creative Nonviolence, CCNV, two blocks from the U.S. Capitol. And there I met Philip Berrigan and Daniel Berrigan, the priest I was telling you about at the beginning. And I ended up living for a year painting houses with Phil Berrigan, who was a defrocked Catholic priest. He married his wife, who was a nun, and he was in jail. And they did a prison marriage ceremony where they married each other. That'll pretty much get you kicked out of the Catholic Church. It shouldn't, by the way, but it did. And, you know, I always like to say, you know, if my Jewish friends can be secular Jews, why can't I be a secular Catholic? Because I was raised in a totally different tradition of Catholicism that had at its heart liberation theology. And liberation theology, as it was understood and promoted in Central Latin America, boiled down to a very simple but dangerous principle that liberation theologians had committed themselves to, that we, meaning the church, have a preferential option for the poor. Wow. We have a preferential option for the poor. That's an incredible statement, and it got priests and nuns murdered. Archbishop Oscar Romero shot through the heart while he was consecrating Eucharist at a mass in 1980. He was killed by people trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas. 1989, six Jesuit priests and the two workers that they had in their house were murdered by a U.S. trained and backed death squad. Six Jesuit priests butchered. Four church women raped and murdered. Sister Deanna Ortiz, who's still alive, tortured repeatedly with a CIA, with people speaking English in the room, and she believes firmly that the CIA was monitoring, if not directing, her torture and her repeated rapes, cigarette burns throughout her body. This is a history embedded within the Catholic Church that speaks to me. But I'm basically an atheist, but I want to also hold on to that part of the tradition. So I poured myself into actually studying the Bible with Phil Berrigan. And if you don't know who he is, you should look him up. I mean, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panther Party, said Phil Berrigan is the baddest white man to ever live. Amazing. But one of my favorite things that I learned when I was, you know, the idea of Jesus as a revolutionary changed the way that I read the Bible. And I'm not here to like proselytize or tell you that you should get into the religion business. But what I'm saying is we're all a product of where we came from. And I think a lot about this lately. You know, Phil said that in the passage where Jesus is asked about paying taxes, and he says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's." And you know, the Republicans, right wing, all the evangelicals, they say, "See, we're supposed to be paying taxes to the government." And Phil said, "Nothing belonged to Caesar." What was being said there? Don't give Caesar. Not render unto Caesar what is Caesar's? Nothing is Caesar's. You know, so there was this way of looking at the world that combined with growing up in the way that I did and fumbling around, you know, in failed attempts to exist in a university atmosphere, and then being exposed to the Berrigan brothers. And then one day, I'm listening to the radio and I hear this amazing voice. And it's a woman who was confronting then Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. And she was, I had never heard a politician grilled the way that this woman on the radio was grilling him. And it turned out that it was Amy Goodman. And it was right around the time when Democracy Now! Was starting as a show. I wrote her an old-fashioned letter. Of course, she doesn't respond. I wrote another letter, doesn't respond. Then I had gone to New York then, and I was living at the Catholic Worker in New York on the Lower East Side. And a lot of what I was doing was giving, was making soup, and I was giving baths to guys who had full-blown AIDS. But my real reason for being in New York and the reason that I went there is I wanted to stalk Amy Goodman in a non-creepy way. So anyway, I'm following Amy everywhere, going to all of her public events, you know, and I'd been writing her things that said, like, I heard you mention that you have a cat. Well, if your cat ever needs feeding, I'll feed your cat. You must have windows. Can I wash your windows? I was trying to think of every possible way of getting this person to say, oh, haha, that's kind of clever. So finally, Amy had to decide whether to let me volunteer on her show or get a restraining order against me. And fortunately, she let me volunteer. And so I list, even to this day on my social media, Democracy Now! As my university. I have some young people that are working with me on the podcast that we do, Intercepted. And, you know, people who have journalism backgrounds can be great. I don't think that it's a worthless pursuit. But the journalists that I've met around the world in war zones who have the most heart were not formally trained as journalists. So they're not kind of poisoned with the notion of objectivity, you know, that they actually live in the world as it is and don't try to give Caesar his say just because Caesar deserves it. No, you don't. The mission is not trust but verify. It should be you don't ever trust them until you can verify that they're telling the truth. It's the opposite of what, you know, what a lot of you'll hear a lot of people say. You don't trust the powerful, and then you verify. If they keep asserting that it's true, you verify it. But if you trust and then verify, You're giving those in power the benefit of the doubt, and they never, ever should get it from journalists. They should never get the benefit of the doubt. You know, we're in this moment right now where it's like we have two realities, and it's not necessarily right and left. There is the fake reality, what I think is the fake reality, that is presented by Fox News and also presented by President Trump on his, as he says, he's one of the largest media outlets in the country because of his following on social media. And lest you think I'm about to be, you know, a partisan here, I got plenty to say about the Democrats in a minute. Let me just give you an example. If the PP tape is real, this is how we have to talk now. We have allegations of the president. There's a PP tape of the president. It may be legit. I know there's a lot of rumors swirling around Washington and some serious people saying some serious things about Russians trying to sell. But at the end of the day, does it matter? Is Trump going to actually say, they got the PP tape? No, he's going to say, fake. They did some digital editing there. We'll never actually know. If that thing exists, we'll never know. And I bring up that kind of ludicrous example because we have a significant chunk of people in this country that if Trump says the sky is actually a rock, then they're going to be talking about the great rock up there. And it's like the rest of us, and it doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, leftist, the rest of us are like, whoa, wait a minute, but that's the sky. We are not even having a debate about the same issues. It's one huge gaslighting operation that this administration and its allies in the media are running. And then on the other side, you have MSNBC and CNN just going overboard on this new Cold War rhetoric, you know, complete with the backwards R, you know, and all their Trump specials. And it's a, you know, none of these dingbats know how to read Cyrillic, and I'm sure none of them are aware that a backwards R is not, in Cyrillic, is not R, it's not R. But why does that matter? It looks so cool. We're making it like the Cold War, you know, and the worst is Rachel Maddow. She is the absolute worst on this. I know, I'm sure there's a lot of people not clapping for me. We should be applying the same standard to the assertions of the Central Intelligence Agency, the NSA, and all of these other entities that we applied critically when they were trying to sell us the idea that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. I, you know, I'm a supporter of Robert Mueller's investigation. I'm also a supporter of widening the criminal investigation into Donald Trump, members of his family, members of his administration. I tend to think that Steve Bannon was actually telling the truth in that book, Fire and Fury, when he said all of this Russia stuff leads to money laundering. I think that is a big chunk of what is actually going to be proven. But because Rachel Maddow and Wolf Blitzer and all these people have just promoted this new Cold War mentality, the idea that the Soviets are still there, that Putin is some Bolshevik, is going to be so damaging unless the facts back up all the hype. Because they are on a fact-free journey into the Netherlands of this Soviet Union is back again. And it's going to undermine the strength of the actual facts at the end of the day. Yeah, Sean Hannity, he's on the hook. He denies that reality is reality. We get it. We know that. Fox News is the official network of white supremacists, nativists, anti-immigrants, anti-women. We know that.
You're listening to Jeremy Scahill, Journalism, Truth or Propaganda. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
And I think that we are doing a disservice to the seriousness of the allegations that are surfacing and continue to surface by pretending as though facts don't matter, that you can make conclusions before you have the facts to back them up. I think it's dangerous. I think what MSNBC is engaged in right now is dangerous. Fox is certainly dangerous. It's in its own category of dangerousness. But MSNBC and CNN, to a lesser extent, are engaged in dangerous propaganda for a case that has not yet been proven. And I'm not looking at this like, I don't believe that it's like no holds barred, anything we can do to get rid of Trump, even lying about that. No. That is going to have a far-reaching set of ramifications for us as a society, for the credibility of the news media in general. And I'm deeply concerned about people who know better and whose track records have proven that they care about facts, all of a sudden becoming totally different people. The one positive that I could see come out of this is that all of these media personalities and journalists and whatever Chuck Todd is and all these people have now, all of a sudden, like one day, like a spine just appeared and they're like, the president is lying. You know, these people, you couldn't find any of them to say things like that during the Bush era in real time. They certainly didn't do it about Obama. But I think it's a good thing that journalists are using the word lie, that the president is lying. I think that's a good thing. I also thought it was a good thing when Bush was there and Obama was there, but you didn't hear it from these people. So now they boxed themselves into a corner where it's regular now, it's normal in our culture to call the president a liar. That's great. That's how it should be. I.F. Stone, yes, would be like, all right, this is great, finally. If a Democrat wins next time, or an acceptable Republican, you know, are they going to have the same standard for how they go after that individual? I don't know. But it reminds me of something that my friend and another mentor of mine, Alan Nairn, who's an amazing journalist, he said when he and I were talking really early on in the Trump administration, and I asked him why he seemed to be kind of going soft on Obama's legacy on foreign policy. And if you know Alan Nairn's work, he's one of the most committed exposers of CIA operations and murderous U.S.-backed death squads. He's a true heroic character. But he said, because I think that there's a value in hypocrisy. I was like, what do you mean? He said, there is real value in hypocrisy. And he said, look, Samantha Power, she's at the United Nations. She claims that she's a humanitarian. She claims that she's, you know, on the side of the people and justice, and that the United States should be a force for good in the world. Well, when she then turns around and votes at the United Nations to continue the unconscionable carpet bombing of Yemen, we at least are talking the same language, and we can say, hey, weren't you the one just telling us about all the human rights that should be respected and humanitarian support? There's a value in hypocrisy. We can debate those people. If Hillary Clinton had won the election, we'd be having a very different set of debates and discussions right now. There would probably be a lot of pressure on her from a variety of activist groups, but we'd be having the same conversation. So there's a value in hypocrisy because it, you know, your opponent, in this case the state, wants to believe that it is doing it. It's the first administration in history that's doing it good. And I think Obama, you can see, I've gone back and I've read every statement he made about killing civilians and drone strikes. And in those words, you see Obama regularly qualifying his defense of the drone program, or qualifying his defense of the iron fist of U.S. militarism, because he knows he's a hypocrite. He knew it the moment he got into that race for president. But that's very different than Donald Trump telling you, you know, that the sky doesn't exist. I mean, it's two different poles. So that's sort of where we're at right now, is that we have the Democrats are have PhDs in things up. And they, I was saying earlier today, it's like the rake has been in their backyard in the same damn spot for generations, and I'll be damned if they don't step back onto it and whack themselves in the face once again, because that's what they do all the time. And, you know, Steve Bannon talks about how, not to keep bringing up Steve Bannon, who's an atrocious human being, but I think he's a brilliant sort of evil genius in some ways, and I think Bannon really, he gets, you know, he sort of gets the big picture on how to seize power. I mean, he was just over in Italy working with the fascists on the right in Italy. But he said that the Democratic Party someday has to have a civil war, and something like a Tea Party is going to emerge from that. I tend to think he's right about that, because I think that the Democratic Party has taken for granted the votes of so many people in this country for so long, and right now there is a real battle going on. We've been reporting on this, on how more progressive candidates are challenging the chosen establishment candidates to run for office in a variety of cities and states across the United States, and the DCCC, you know, which is the main fundraising organ for all these congressional races, is actively trying to stop more progressive candidates from taking on their corporate Democrats. And it's a huge mistake. You know, the Bernie Sanders moment in this country, the thing that I think was that Bernie did that actually will endure, is he pushed back the idea that the word socialism is a bad word. And I think a lot of young people were inspired by that. I don't know what Bernie's organization is going to do. To me, it's not about Bernie. It's about, do we want to shatter the existing order of the two-party system in this country? And do we do it? Well, if Bernie Sanders had run as an independent, he would have been blamed for giving us Donald Trump. If Bernie Sanders concedes to Hillary Clinton, he's going to be blamed for giving us Donald. I mean, he was in a position where there was literally nothing he could have done to not be blamed for Donald Trump by the broader elite Democrats. But so what does this all mean? Well, in 2018, it's not a shoo-in that the Democrats take back one or both of those houses. They should, but do not underestimate their ability to f*** it up. And if they don't in 2018, Trump's going to finish this term. I think it's actually more likely that Trump will get hit with a criminal indictment than he will be impeached, and that's going to be a really interesting situation. As for war, one of the things that I find amazing and yet so perfect for this moment is that Eric Prince, the owner or the founder of Blackwater, still has access to Donald Trump and has been pitching this plan for a privatized intelligence force that would allow Trump to circumvent the deep state. He's working on it with a former dirty ops guy for career in the CIA, and they've been pitching this. Meanwhile, Eric Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, is the Secretary of Education. And what Eric Prince wants to do for the U.S. national security apparatus, a privatized warfare offering it to corporations, foreign governments, etc., is similar to what, if Betsy DeVos can be accused of having ideas, is what her idea is for education. This woman didn't set foot in a public school until she became education secretary. She's the education secretary and had never been in a public school, but she knows a lot about public schools. She knows a lot about the budgets of public schools because she wants to take those budgets for public schools and give them to religious schools or private schools or for-profit charter schools. You know, my sister was teaching at one of these garbage charter schools in a hardcore area of Philadelphia, and the who was running that charter school for profit, his Facebook said, "I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman." That's the guy who's like, he's quoting like Jay-Z, and he's running a charter school in an entirely black neighborhood of Philadelphia. What's wrong with these people? Seriously. And they name them like Malcolm X Academy or Nelson Mandela Academy. And when George Bush came here, he went to Milwaukee to do it. He got old Howard Fuller up there with him, you know, former superintendent of schools in Milwaukee. And he got him to sell this idea with, you know, all of the bishops and ministers and everything. It's like, oh, this is a faith-based initiative. No, what these people want to do is loot public monies and transition them back into their chosen private sector friends. But the stakes right now are so high. You have an utter massacre going on in Yemen that was entirely made possible by the United States government. President Obama initiated what was at first a covert bombing campaign in December of 2009. And the first strike that Barack Obama authorized in Yemen was not a drone strike. It was a cruise missile strike. And it was a cruise missile strike against a suspected al-Qaeda stronghold, an al-Qaeda training camp. And it wasn't just cruise missiles. They used cluster bombs, banned under international conventions. Mr. Nobel Peace Prize winner authorized the use of cluster munitions. For those of you who don't know what a cluster bomb is, and I've seen the aftermath of them, they're like flying landmines that shred human beings and animals into ground meat when they hit. It's a horrifying weapon, and Obama chose that weapon for the first strike that he authorized in Yemen, and it turned out that it was not an al-Qaeda training camp. In fact, they haven't been able to produce the name of any al-Qaeda person that they claim that they killed, except one guy who they, and this is so bizarre for anyone who knows anything about U.S. history, had been a mujahideen in Afghanistan. You mean like Congressman Dana Rohrabacher? He was a mujahideen in Afghanistan. He was a white mujahideen in Afghanistan along with, but they float that, and no one in the press says anything about it. They say, oh, he was a mujahideen. No, that's half of Yemen was in Afghanistan. It was the number one nation in the world sending foreign fighters to Afghanistan to fight against the Russians, on the same side as the United States, by the way. So he drops these cluster munitions, and they kill 36 women and children. There were only a handful of men there that day. And that then kicks off years of sustained bombing through drone strikes, helicopter strikes, cruise missile strikes, authorized by Obama. There had only been one drone strike on Yemen during the entire period of George W. Bush's time in office, and it was in November of 2002. Obama then started it so that they were hitting Yemen multiple times a week at some points in drone strikes and others. And every time, we killed militants, we killed al-Qaeda trainers or facilitators, and no names are ever produced. For the most part, no names are ever produced. I would go and investigate strikes where they said terrorists were killed, and then you go there and you look at the documentation, and it's like it was these people's wedding day, or it was a funeral. You know, I'm not saying there aren't terrorists. I'm not saying that Obama didn't kill dangerous people. Of course there were dangerous people that were killed. Was anyone killed who represented an imminent threat to the United States, which was the standard that he said he was operating under? Come on. Imminent threat? They got so creative in the Obama Justice Department and with their legal counsel that they redefined the term imminent to such a degree that it bared no resemblance to its actual meaning, where the idea that someone who ever has been in contact with someone that we believe might be a terrorist represents an ongoing imminent threat to the United States. It wasn't that exactly, but you can read it yourself. It was a DOJ white paper that basically redefined the English word for imminent. You know, I mean, it's incredible. So Obama, when he gets into office and he starts this Yemen thing, then he starts sending people back into Somalia, he starts whacking Pakistan left and right with drone strikes all the time. He's giving authorization for U.S. Special Operations Forces to do an increasing number of ground incursions into a variety of so-called theaters around the world. Why did Obama do this? It's interesting. When you secure the nomination for either major party, you then get a fairly high-level security briefing. You remember there was a lot of controversy about this with Donald Trump. They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to give it to him. They thought, rightly so, that he would start tweeting things out that they told him. And But Obama's, I remember this because I knew it was happening. Obama gets his briefing from, you know, the top dogs at NSA, CIA, et cetera, at the federal building in Chicago. And the next day, Obama's entire way of talking about counterterrorism operations changed. And one thing that the CIA and the NSA, to an extent the FBI, but it's really the CIA and the military, one thing that they are very good at is scaring the shit out of incoming presidents. And so you have someone like Obama who's sitting there listening to briefing after briefing after briefing about, if you don't authorize this, Mr. President, there could be an attack on the homeland. Rahm Emanuel at the time, totally inappropriate, but Rahm Emanuel is in the room just thinking about it in terms of how will this affect the re-election. We're talking about the first year into the administration. Rahm Emanuel is thinking about counterterrorism policy through the lens of electoral politics rather than the national security of the United States. And Obama basically gets given such a small list of options that he picks what he thinks is the least bad, which is the CIA JSOC plan, the Joint Special Operations Command. Mr. President, no more big land war. I know you're going to do it in Afghanistan. I know the surge is going to happen. But listen, we can do this discreetly around the world. We've done it before. We have the greatest professionals in the world. We'll do surgical drone strikes. We'll do a selective insertion of special operations teams into a variety of theaters, and we are going to destroy and disrupt these terror networks. And that was the idea that Obama bought into. He bought into the narrative of the war on terror presented to him by some of the most unsavory forces in the U.S. arsenal. And he did it because he thought that it was a smarter alternative to what he called dumb wars when he first came out against the Iraq War in October of 2002 in Chicago. So you have Obama then really double down and commit to this particular way of waging a so-called war on terrorism. And for Dick Cheney, all the criticism that he levied against Obama, and he was constantly bashing Obama during the 8 years, but I'm sorry, Dick Cheney must have loved that administration on a foreign policy level, because Obama was able to sell the idea to liberals in this country that drone strikes, even drone strikes against American citizens who have not been charged with crimes, are perfectly acceptable. That's something that no Republican would have been able to do. Obama put his credibility and his legitimacy and his smarts and the perception of him as the candidate of change, he put all of that on the line to defend the core tenets of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld's vision for how the U.S. military and the CIA should be functioning in the world today. He was the one who made it continue unabated because he sold it to liberals. If John McCain or Mitt Romney had come in, no way they would have been able to get away with some of what Obama did. But because Obama was Obama, that system continued on. And it's why, at the very end of Obama's administration, he was scrambling to try to implement rules for how drone strikes would be conducted, for how high-value targeting assassination operations would be conducted. And he said that the reason that he was doing it is because he wanted to make sure that there was accountability in place for whoever comes next. Well, too late. You operated a parallel justice system in the White House during the entire 8 years of your presidency, where you, as president, served as the judge, jury, prosecutor, executioner of people who had not been charged with crimes around the world. And at the 11th hour, you're going to say, well, we better put some rules in place because that next guy. The policy boiled down to this. Obama sold it as, trust me. And that doesn't work. That's a bad precedent. Does anyone trust Trump in that way? Even if you say, well, I did trust Obama. My God, what don't we think deeper than just the moment that we're in? So many bad precedents were set under that administration. And what has Trump done? He has multifold expanded drone strikes. He has given the military, he's allowed the military off the leash when it comes to a variety of the rules of engagement and the acceptable threshold of civilians being killed. He is running around the world, has the military running around the world doing God knows what, because he's not even paying attention to it. He's supposed to get this presidential daily briefing every day. All presidents get it, and the president can select how he wants to receive it. Obama was known for wanting a lot more information than almost any of his predecessors that people could recall. Trump wants pictures and graphs and bullet points, and some There are some reports from the individuals who spoke anonymously to media that are involved with the process of preparing the daily brief. It say that they started putting Trump's name into the points that they really want to make sure that he reads, because the first thing he looks for on any document is his name, and to see what, you know, what kind of reviews is he getting from the CIA. So that's the world that we're in right now with Donald Trump. But let's not pretend that Donald Trump is somehow history's greatest monster. He's not even close yet in a body count to what Cheney and Bush did. You know, he's not close to what we saw during the Vietnam War. I mean, Trump is a junior varsity player. Even according to his first year in office, he is not history's greatest monster. So what's the thread of all this? The thread is that we have to think beyond just, oh my God, we have to get rid of Trump. The way it's done is going to set a precedent. The way we as a society understand this moment is going to have a great impact on our media culture, on the open nature of debate in our society, on the U.S. economy, on world peace. This is a very serious moment that we're in. And my greatest concern on a foreign policy level about Donald Trump when it comes to war is that no one is watching the CIA. No one is watching the special operations forces and the military. Trump defers so much to the generals. He says, just do what's necessary. The CIA right now is in a golden era of unaccountability because no one is paying attention. Not the White House, not the Congress. All of the members of the Intelligence Committee who are supposed to be doing oversight on the CIA, what are they doing right now? Trump, Russia, Trump, Russia, Trump, Russia. All day long. What the hell's the CIA doing? When's the last time they had a hearing on what the CIA is doing? It's really incredible that we are allowing all of this to just sort of unfold in front of our eyes, and no one is sort of saying, well, wait a minute, have we not studied the Church Commission? Have we not studied political assassinations? Have we not studied Vietnam? You know, Trump, one of the ideas Eric Prince floated to Trump was bring back the Phoenix program and make it a global one. I mean, the ideas that are being floated, and they just kind of come and go on Twitter. There's some serious, serious stuff going down right now all around the world, and none of the people who were elected to oversee it, who serve on the committees that are supposed to be holding them accountable, are doing anything anymore that's not related to Trump Russia. So we need to organize our priorities in this society. We can't just fall into the trap of thinking all evil began with Donald Trump. It matters what the CIA is doing right now. It matters what the U.S. military is doing right now. But we're all stuck in this sort of jerk chain with Trump and his Twitter feed. And the fact that the most influential trio of people are not the heads of the United States military, the head of the CIA, and the head of the NSA. The most influential people in this country right now are the three imbeciles who host Fox and Friends. A weatherman, a sportscaster, and a rotation of blonde white women. There's a new one every few months. Those three people have more influence over American policy today than the heads of intelligence agencies because of the way that Trump operates. I want to end by saying this. We should not allow George W. Bush to be rehabilitated in front of our eyes. I don't care if he spends most of his time painting today. You know, David Frum is not my friend. I am not on David Frum's side. David Frum wrote the Axis of Evil speech. David Frum was an unrepentant neocon. Bill Kristol, who was one of the most vile of them, for years ran the Weekly Standard, one of the biggest cheerleaders for neocon foreign policy. All these people that are now on MSNBC and CNN, you know, the never Trumpers, it's fine to interview people like that. But seriously, you're not going to ask them about their role in the deaths of upwards of a million people in Iraq? They're just allowed to be normal members of society who can just analyze Donald Trump when they were a part of the destruction and the fires that are still raging throughout the Middle East. We're going to have them on TV and no one's going to ask them about this stuff? That's the problem. It's not that we shouldn't talk to people like that. It's that there are certain people that you don't talk to unless the first question is, how come you're not in jail? But it doesn't happen. And that is a problem for us that's going to endure when war criminals and others can be so quickly reintegrated into society because, oh my God, the reality TV show is the host. We need all hands on deck. Somebody get Bill Kristol. Somebody get Eric Holder. No, no. Sometimes the truth is just true. And sometimes facts are more important than your perception of the urgency of the situation. And we're in one of those moments right now. Yes, Trump is a danger. Yes, he's a threat. Yes, there are frightening aspects. Yes, there are things that are unique to Trump that we haven't seen before in American politics. But people, we shouldn't lose our heads, because there are very powerful players who never have to run for re-election, who never have to appear in front of a Senate committee, that can wait out any democratically elected administration. That's written throughout the history of the CIA. It's throughout the history of special operations forces. For young people out here, for students that are here today, if your path is finishing your degree and going on to get a master's degree or a PhD, more power to you. I look forward to seeing what you're going to do. But there are probably people in this audience, too, that are struggling. And I bet that somewhere within them, they have a fire that burns for something meaningful, for something that they want to do. If you want to be a journalist, what's more important than any piece of paper or internship is that it burns in your heart, that it's not your job, it's who you are, that you believe in justice. You believe that facts matter, that the voices of the voiceless need to be heard, and sometimes you have to be the in the room that stands up and says, no, I'm not going to participate in this collective fairy tale that we're all building around us right now. You have a great opportunity in front of you in this country right now, young people. And I take great inspiration from so many young activists who are on the front lines facing down against police killing of unarmed Black and other people of color in this country, to those students at Parkland who are now under the attack of the right-wing media and political elite in this country. Young people are showing such spark, such creativity, and such commitment right now. And I think that the way forward is those of us who have gray, been around the block a few times, maybe are octogenarians, and you've been there and done that on so many struggles. If we can combine that wisdom, the scholarship, the study, if you take what is so important about the wisdom of our elders and you combine it with the innovation, the creativity, the energy of young people, then I think we're going to actually be talking about changing things. The issue of objectivity, point out for me, an objective journalist. Was Judy Miller an objective journalist when she was pushing the lies of the George W. Bush White House? Let me tell you how that worked. Dick Cheney calls up Judy Miller. There's a mushroom cloud scenario. There's going to be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Then Judy Miller prints it. It goes to the front page. Then Dick Cheney appears on Meet the Press and says, well, the New York Times is saying that there's a mushroom cloud. The idea that objectivity has any relationship to facts is insane. Yes, journalists should get their facts straight. They should be transparent about it. But the idea that anyone by nature is objective, or that objectivity, if you study U.S. journalism from World War II to the present, what you will see is that objectivity is a cudgel that is used to hammer people that actually hold the government accountable. It basically means the government always has to have its say. And I'm sorry, I don't believe that, well, we need the Democratic view and the Republican view, because there's so many more views than that. The way objectivity is defined in American journalism today is to defend the ultra-powerful. The only crack we're seeing in that is because of Trump and who Trump is. But I would be willing to bet that a lot of those journalists that are calling the president liar, liar, liar right now, their conscience is going to take a hike the next time that a established member of the elite resides in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Thank you to everyone. Sorry I went on a bit long. Happy to listen to questions or comments. If that guy wants to go out in the hall, he can give a speech and you can listen to him. Thank you, University of Wisconsin. Thank you to the students who organized this. Thank you to Alfred McCoy. I'm really honored to be here with you.
That was Jeremy Scahill, Journalism, Truth or Propaganda. He spoke at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Jeremy Scahill is an award-winning journalist and author of the bestsellers Blackwater and Dirty Wars. He's a founding editor of The Intercept. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Ramzi Baroud, Michelle Alexander, Noam Chomsky, Glenn Greenwald, Michael Parenti, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. We have a series of programs on journalism. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Norm Stockwell recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.